Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, January 4, 2024. I'm your reader, Kathleen. Here's our article from the front page, Some Cedar Rapids Apartments Not Safe to Occupy. This story by Marissa Payne. Some residents of West Hill Village Apartments in northwest Cedar Rapids were ordered this week to leave their homes by the end of the month after an engineer this week found structural issues in three buildings, including cracks in the drywall and floor unevenness that may lead to a potential structural failure. Residents of the buildings at 1610, 1620, and 1630 Seminole Avenue Northwest were given 30 days by Waterloo-based EPM Iowa, the private property management company, to vacate the properties. The city of Cedar Rapids is requiring residents to leave to allow for repairs of structural problems, some stemming from the 2020 derecho. Antonio Chalmers, age 35, who has lived in a two-bedroom apartment in the 1620 building since August of 2022, is a touring artist known as Tone DeBoss and preparing to travel most of January. With little notice, he now has to find a place to live, move his belongings, and secure money for that move. Since receiving notice to vacate, Chalmers said he's looked at over a dozen apartments in town, but all cost more than the $620 a month he pays in rent, and most offer less space. He has no idea where he'll go. The property manager's note on residents' doors suggested residents search for available units rented through the company, but most of those units are in Waterloo. I don't have much family options out here to stay that has any extra rooms, so I may have to live out of state, Chalmers said. I have an 8-year-old daughter that goes to school here who stays with me primarily and now has to stay with her mom. A December 29 City Building Services staff letter shows the owner has enlisted an additional structural engineering firm to examine the properties and is evaluating appropriate steps. The three properties will be placarded for no occupancy February 1 unless repairs are made and approved by a registered design professional before the January 31 deadline for residents to vacate, according to the letter. EPM Iowa did not respond to the Gazette's request for comment on Wednesday. Besides the brief letter taped to residents' doors, Chalmers said there hasn't been in-depth contact with property managers. He's uncertain when repairs could be made if residents are ever allowed to return. We're human beings and all of our lives are changing in 30 days, Chalmers said. Help us relocate. Not everybody's even tech savvy. I feel so bad for the more elderly families that don't know what to do, don't even know how to maneuver around the website to find something. During a regular city rental inspection on June 2, 2023, of the five buildings at West Hill Village Apartments, 1610, 1630 Seminole Avenue Northwest, the building services staff observed locations where the exterior balcony's deck joists were deteriorated at the connection to the building cantilever, and the outer rim boards were so deteriorated as to be disconnected, according to the report. This was after an April 14 inspection revealed code infractions, necessitating another inspection to determine whether infractions had been corrected or needed further attention. Staff determined the balconies were potentially dangerous for continued use and required closing the exterior balconies to residents. City staff have been in contact with the property owner on a plan to replace or remove the balconies. On December 12, the Building Services Department received correspondence from the Iowa City-based Axiom Consultants about potential safety concerns and the structural integrity of the five buildings. A letter dated December 5, signed by Axiom owner Robert Decker, stated that a prospective buyer enlisted the firm to assess the five-building complex during the 45-day due diligence period before the sale of the building. It's unknown if the sale is proceeding and how that might affect residents. After a November 2 and 6 site visit, Axiom shared certain issues warranted further investigation to ensure the safety of the residents, including the degraded condition of balconies. Additional concerns reported by maintenance staff and some residents, according to Axiom's report, included extensive cracking in the walls and ceiling at balcony door locations, with truss-bearing locations visible, as well as visible cracking at interior doorways. When the Building Services Department received the report December 12, the department notified owners they need a structural engineer to examine all five buildings and determine whether they are safe for continued occupancy. The department received a copy of the structural engineer's report by Natalia Hunt of Apex Structural, a Cedar Rapids metro-based company, from the owners December 28. After conducting an assessment of the 1610, 1620, and 1630 buildings, Hunt reported cracks in the drywall of the stairwell, suggesting there was significant lateral movement in the structure, most likely related to 2020 derecho damage. Vertical cracks in the drywall above sliding doors, with about 30% of the apartments showing stress cracks on the drywall above the doors and floor joists punching through the ceiling drywall. Floor unevenness revealing a serious issue that can lead to a potential structural failure, as the interior wall is placed directly on the floor decking without structural support below it. Sagging ceiling in one third floor apartment, a termite issue in the 1620 building. Given the gravity of these findings, it is my professional opinion that the apartment complex is not safe to occupy in the current conditions and ongoing issues, Hunt wrote. The buildings require immediate repairs to prevent further deterioration and ensure the safety and integrity of the apartment complex. It is strongly advised that residents evacuate the buildings before doing any repairs. The evacuation should be executed promptly, preferably within the next 30 to 60 days. The Building Services Department notified the property owner that the 1610, 1620, and 1630 buildings were to be evacuated as soon as possible, no later than 11:59 p.m. January 31st. The letter was signed by Building Services Director Kevin Chiabotti and Code Enforcement Manager Greg Bulow. A report regarding the 1615 and 1625 buildings is required before February 1st, indicating whether those two properties can be safely occupied. Since a new property management company took over around the fall of 2022, staff have entered units to conduct inspections almost every week, predating city inspections, Chalmers said. In July, residents' decks were boarded up. They've been doing a lot of inspections but haven't really said much as to why, Chalmers said. Looking back at it, I feel like they were aware there were these issues and didn't say anything. According to the Building Services Department, the city is in contact with the West Hill Village Apartments owner, the owner's authorized agent, and the private property management company. Under housing and property maintenance codes adopted by the city, the owner or the owner's authorized agent is responsible for compliance with code violations. Residents seeking assistance in finding housing may contact Waypoints Housing Services team at 319-366-7999. The city has shared resource information with the property owner and property management company, according to the department, and the property managers have been working with residents to assess needs. A GoFundMe, Help Families in Need of Relocation, has been set up to assist approximately 24 families and potentially more if the other two buildings are vacated with relocation expenses. The last thing I was expecting was an eviction, Chalmers said. So also on the front page, Linn County Jail may end agreement with the U.S. government to house federal inmates, this story by Emily Anderson. The Linn County Jail may stop housing federal inmates for the U.S. Marshals Service if the two organizations can't come to an agreement in the next few weeks. The intergovernmental agreement between the two agencies, which dictates how much the Marshals Service pays the county per inmate per day and what the responsibilities of each organization are for those inmates expired in October 2023, according to Linn County Sheriff Brian Gardner. The two agencies began the negotiation process for a new contract in December 2022. But after over a year of negotiating, we have been unsuccessful in reaching a new agreement, Gardner said. Since the contract expired, the organizations have continued following the stipulations outlined in the previous agreement, which had the federal government paying Linn County $86 per inmate per day to house federal inmates. It also pays $43 per hour for time spent by Linn County deputies transporting and guarding federal inmates outside of the jail. In fiscal 2023, the U.S. Marshals Service paid the county $2,499,848 for housing inmates. Gardner said there were more than 100 federal inmates in the jail during most of that fiscal year, but over time the number has decreased. Recently, there have been fewer than 30 inmates in the jail. And on December 21, Gardner provided the federal government with a 30-day notice of intent to terminate their housing agreement, meaning the U.S. Marshals Service has until January 20 to either reach an agreement with the county or remove its inmates from the jail. Gardner did not say what parts of the contract were in dispute, but said he intends to release that information after the January 20 deadline has passed. The sheriff's office made a slight adjustment to the agreement with the U.S. Marshals Service in August 2022 in order to reduce overtime worked by jail staff. The previous contract stated that the county government agreed to provide transportation for federal inmates subject to the availability of its personnel. This previously meant that two deputies were required to accompany federal inmates when they left the jail for things like a doctor's appointment or to go to the hospital. Taking federal inmates to medical appointments was contributing to excessive overtime by jail staff, so the sheriff's office asked the federal agency to transport their own detainees to and from scheduled medical appointments and to take over the responsibility of guarding federal detainees within 10 hours of them being admitted to a hospital. Turning now to Iowa Today News, Iowa City Council passes resolution calling for ceasefire in Gaza. This story by Marissa Payne. In a split vote, the Iowa City Council on Tuesday answered community calls to pass a resolution urging a permanent ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, seeking to support the rights of all people in Palestine and Israel to live in peace and security. The measure, adopted in a 4-3 vote by the 7-member council, was supported by community members who oppose the nearly 3-month war between Israel and the Hamas militant group. In an October 7 attack on Israel, Hamas killed about 1,200 people and kidnapped more than 200, including some Americans, triggering the ongoing war. With the resolution's passage, Iowa City joins a growing number of Democratic-led cities around the U.S. that have passed resolutions, a mostly symbolic sign calling for a ceasefire. The UN General Assembly last month overwhelmingly voted in support of a humanitarian ceasefire, but the U.S. vetoed the resolution. Mayor Bruce Teague, who voted for the resolution, with council members Laura Burgess, Andrew Dunn, and Mazahir Saleh, said at least 16 people worked on the resolution with city officials. He said city officials felt it was important to create a document that represents the thoughts of the community. We do recognize that this document can be viewed by many in various lights, but our true hope was to really find a way to express ourselves, to show the love and support for all Palestinian and Israeli individuals that live in our community, Teague said. Iowa City's resolution calls for a ceasefire and asks for the return of all hostages and the delivery of humanitarian aid. It also opposes anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and anti-Arab bigotry. The city condemns the October 7 attack by Hamas, as well as the killing of civilians in Gaza and the West Bank. The resolution's passage comes after the Israeli military announced it would pull thousands of troops out of the Gaza Strip, a sign of longer-term, lower-intensity fighting against Hamas terrorists, the AP reported. International pressure has mounted for Israel to scale back its military offensive, as nearly 22,000 Palestinians have been killed in the war. Hamas still holds more than 100 hostages in Gaza. Under the resolution, Iowa City asks that the congressional delegation support all resolutions and legislation that align with the values of the city resolution, particularly those intended to alleviate the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. It also affirms citizens' First Amendment rights to criticize the government and affirms that criticism of governments in Israel and Palestine is not inherently anti-Semitic or anti-Arab, shooting back at GOP politicians who have labeled pro-Palestinian protesters advocating for peace as anti-Semitic or Hamas sympathizers. Council members who opposed the resolution said they voted against it because they wanted more time to gain broader community support, but Burgess said inaction maintains the status quo and also causes harm. Of those who opposed the measure, council member Sean Harmson favored more time and said while addressing a global injustice, he didn't want to risk alienating parts of the Iowa City community. Council members Josh Moe and Megan Alter said they supported a strong resolution, deploring violence in the Middle East and senseless killing, but favored a pause to consider the language. "I don't know that we have heard the whole community," Alter said. Dima Toda, a Palestinian-American resident of Iowa City, said the resolution has received public endorsement from 20 organizations and more than 140 people since Sunday morning. "Looking at this council today, I envy you because each one of you has a voice today, a platform you have earned with this council seat," Toda said. "We as U.S. citizens have not been given a choice about whether we support Israel's bombing and killing of Palestinians, mass destruction of Palestinian society and infrastructure. Washington has not heard us, so we've come to you to amplify our voices." The council chambers erupted in applause when Burgess said this was a challenging topic to face in the first meeting of the year, but that as elected officials, their challenge is to decide when to draw the lines rather than pursue perfection. "We will never hear from 100% of the community, and we will never have 100% of a community in agreement," Burgess said. Council member Salih said that Iowa City residents drafted a bold resolution. She said the resolution didn't mean the city was picking a side, but instead opposing violence. "We just don't like killing in general," Salih said. "We are not going to be perfect." And also in Iowa Today News, the Cedar Rapids Police Department is seeking help identifying a suspect in a bank robbery that took place Wednesday morning. The robbery happened around 9 a.m. at Cedar Rapids Bank and Trust, 5400 Council Street Northeast. The robber, described as a white male with a slender build, displayed a gun during a robbery, a police department news release states. The man was about 5'10", last seen wearing a gray or green coat, work gloves, a Hawkeye knit hat, and a black mask. Anyone with information is asked to call Cedar Rapids Police at 319-286-5491 or the Linn County Crime Stoppers at 800-272-7463. Police did not say how much money was stolen in the robbery. And a man was found dead outside Taft Middle School on Wednesday morning after a medical emergency. First responders were called to the middle school at 5200 E Avenue Northwest at 8:30 a.m. for a report of an unresponsive adult male. According to a news release from the Cedar Rapids Police Department, medical personnel determined the man was deceased. An email sent to parents by Taft Principal Gary Hatfield said the medical incident did not involve any Taft students or staff. "While we believe no students witnessed the incident, they may have seen police and emergency vehicles on school premises," the email states. No additional information has been released about the identity of the man or the cause of death. This story by Emily Anderson is titled Records: Man Shot AR-15 at Cedar Rapids Police. A 20-year-old man identified Wednesday by authorities as Michael Griffin of Cedar Rapids fired an assault-style rifle at police officers as they pursued him on New Year's Day before a deadly shootout, records show. An application for court approval to search a cell phone officers believed to have belonged to Griffin sheds more light on events early Monday that began with reports of a drive-by shooting and ended miles away as Cedar Rapids officers forced a fleeing Griffin off the road and returned his fire. Griffin was found dead in his car after five officers fired, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, which is reviewing the officer-involved shooting. A search warrant affidavit filed Wednesday states that Griffin had talked early Monday with the occupants of 414 Longwood Drive Northeast while displaying a black AR-15-style rifle. He demanded they tell him the whereabouts of someone he identified only by a street name. They persuaded him to leave, but shortly after, gunfire started hitting the house, the affidavit said. Police were called to the area of the drive-by shooting at 6:24 a.m. Monday. Witnesses described seeing shots coming from a dark sedan, the warrant request states. As Cedar Rapids police officers were driving to the area, they spotted a car that matched the description, and it had a bag covering its license plate. Police attempted to pull it over, but the car sped up and fled at speeds of up to 75 miles per hour. Two people were inside the car, one of whom got out during the chase and was taken into custody. The driver then continued fleeing, according to the warrant request. The passenger, identified as a 17-year-old boy, told police that Griffin was the driver and was armed with an AR-15. Gunshots started coming toward officers through the driver's side window and also through the back window of the car while the chase was ongoing, the record states. An officer stopped the car with a pit maneuver, and it came to rest in the 5600 block of Mount Vernon Road Southeast. At this point, the car driven by Michael Griffin was disabled. Upon officers' approach, a gunshot was heard coming from inside Michael's car. Believing that Michael was continuing to fire, officers returned fire and subsequently stopped the threat, the warrant request states. When officers approached the car, they found Griffin deceased inside, according to the warrant request. No officers were injured. Five officers shot at Griffin, but it is not clear how many rounds struck him. An autopsy was performed by the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny, but the final results may not be available for 4 or 5 weeks, the DCI said. The officers have been placed on leave while the DCI investigates the shooting, which is routine for an officer-involved shooting. The names of the involved officers have not been released. The DCI said Wednesday it is investigating the chase and the officer-involved shooting, while Cedar Rapids police are investigating the drive-by shooting. And this story also on the Iowa Today page, Running Marquardt to Lead Lynn Supervisors, this by Marissa Payne. The Lynn County Board of Supervisors on Wednesday appointed Supervisor Kirsten Running Marquardt as chair of the three-member board for 2024. She succeeds Republican Supervisor Louis Zumbach as chair. Running Marquardt, a Democrat, represents District 1 that encompasses West Cedar Rapids, Fairfax, Walford, and Ely, as well as unincorporated Lynn County west of the Cedar River. She was elected in 2022 to a 4-year term through 2026. Running Marquardt graduated from LaSalle High School, attended Kirkwood Community College, and earned her bachelor's degree from the University of Iowa and her master's degree from the University of Northern Iowa. She lives on the west side of Cedar Rapids. Supervisor Ben Rogers, also a Democrat, was appointed vice chair of the board. Rogers first was elected in 2008 when the board expanded from 3 members to 5. then in 2012 and 2016, and in 2018 when all supervisor seats were on the ballot amid the board's reduction from 5 to 3 members. He was most recently elected in 2022. Rogers from Cedar Rapids received a bachelor's from the University of Iowa and earned a master's from Mount Mercy University in strategic leadership. He represents District 2 that includes the east side of Cedar Rapids and Hiawatha. Supervisor Louis Zumbach, a Republican, served as board chair in 2023. Turning now to the Insight page, 24-hour Doorman today is titled, Reynolds Loves Making It Tougher. Governor Kim Reynolds has released a diet plan for about 24,000 Iowa kids next summer. It's the No EBT Cards for You diet. It's for their own good. No, I don't think Reynolds is trying to starve kids, but it was a lousy decision to turn down $29 million in federal summer food assistance for kids in low-income households. Each eligible child would have received an EBT card worth $40 monthly. The state would pay a $2.2 million share of administrative costs. But the governor argued the EBT cards would do nothing to promote nutrition at a time when childhood obesity has become an epidemic. So the governor figures poor people will just blow the money on junk food. She wants to enhance existing anti-hunger programs, but she offered no details. It's true, recipients of the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, can buy soda and other sweetened drinks. A study released in 2017 of the buying habits of SNAP and non-SNAP shoppers found pop was the number one item purchased by low-income households. It accounted for 5% of purchases. Overall, they spent 9.3% of benefits on sweetened drinks. But non-SNAP consumers spent 7.1% on sugary drinks. Bottom line, SNAP households bought slightly more junk food than non-recipients, but their buying patterns are very similar. Should federal dollars be spent on unhealthy drinks? A strong case can be made to cut off the soda stream, but instead of blaming low-income families, maybe the governor could place the blame where it belongs, with beverage corporations that have lobbied against such restrictions while marketing sugar water as sports drinks. And tens of millions of bushels of Iowa corn go into high-fructose corn syrup, which sweetens some of these beverages. I doubt the governor will bring that up. A survey of studies by the Food Resource and Action Center found plenty of evidence that food insecurity actually leads to obesity. People with low incomes and a lack of transportation often are left to buy food at convenience stores that offer few healthy choices. Denying them additional help is not going to reduce obesity. And Reynolds' obesity argument would be more believable if Iowa wasn't, yet again, in a parade of red states turning down federal aid. Reynolds signed legislation last year creating a new bureaucracy of eligibility checks and asset tests that make it harder for Iowans to receive SNAP assistance and keep it. The governor also has turned down tens of millions of dollars in federal help addressing COVID testing in schools during the pandemic, climate change preparedness, affordable housing, and childcare. So her food aid refusal seems to be more about slapping the president than helping Iowans. Representative Sammy Sheets, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, offered a bill last session to expand free school lunches, which are subject to nutrition rules. He had 20 Republican co-sponsors, giving the bill enough support for passage. Republican leaders didn't bring it up for a vote. So the tough love keeps coming. The governor loves making life tougher for low-income families. We have community letters today, beginning with this one titled, Haley is Pro-Business, Will Restore America's Economy. As the co-owner of one of the largest manufacturing businesses in Iowa, I know firsthand how critical we are to Iowa's economy and the entire nation's. Iowa drives America's food production, exports over $17 billion worth of goods annually, and supplies over 300,000 jobs in my home state. Iowa keeps America afloat, and I want a president who will fight for business, not just on the campaign trail, but in the Oval Office. The leader I am confident will stand up for us is Nikki Haley. As governor of South Carolina, Haley understood that her businesses and manufacturers were her partners. She empowered them by cutting red tape and relieving burdensome regulations. And she didn't stop there. During her tenure, Haley slashed taxes to give breathing room, which allowed employers to invest in their employees and build new infrastructure. Haley's pro-business strategy worked, and in return, she created thousands of jobs and turned the Palmetto State into an economic powerhouse. In today's economic blues of high interest rates and inflation, America could use a pro-business, conservative leader like Nikki Haley, someone who treats employers like friends, not enemies to regulate and burden with cumbersome taxes. I believe Nikki Haley is the new face for 8 years of conservative leadership. She's tough, strong, morally clear, and she thinks outside the box. I think her pro-jobs approach can fix our nation's struggling economy. I urge you to join me in caucusing for Nikki on January 15. And that's signed by Steve Sukup from Sheffield. This next letter is titled, Calls for Ceasefire in Gaza, Not Anti-Semitic. Every day the news reports tell me of more civilian deaths in Gaza, of direct killings and unendurable living conditions. Innocent people are dying, and a great many of them children. They will soon be dying even more rapidly as disease ravages the camps and shelters where the children and their families are trapped. When is America going to demand an end to the killing of children and their families? Children are being forced into tighter and tighter spaces and slaughtered. American money is paying for the armaments used to do this. Children are dying and Americans are paying to let it happen. This isn't about anti-Semitism or any other ism. It's about babies and toddlers and little girls and little boys and the mothers and fathers who are trying to keep them safe. It is way past time to demand an end to this horror. And that letter is signed by Myrna Lorlin from Cedar Rapids. And our last letter is titled, Thanks to People, Businesses Behind Five Seasons Lights. Between Christmas and New Year's, we twice visited the lights at the McGrath Amphitheater. Twinkling lights combined with pleasant music to create a wondrous atmosphere reinforced by the laughter and smiles of other visitors. It was a joyous place, providing a brief break from depressing world and national events. Thanks to those people and businesses who made it possible. And that's signed by Marion and Rich Patterson from Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, January 4, on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First in Coralville, Andrew Sebastian Christensen, age 43, died October 26, 2023. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service. In Decorah, Alice Sheedle, 92, died Wednesday, January 3. Helms Funeral Home is assisting. In Luana, Oswald, known as Ozzy William Gettler, age 96, died Wednesday, January 3. Leonard Graw Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Monona. In Maquoketa, Dean Penning Roth, age 60, died Monday, January 1st, Carson Celebration of Life Center. In Monmouth, Ronald G. Helwig, age 78, died Friday, December 29, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. And in West Liberty, Maria Elizondo, age 80, died Tuesday, January 2nd. Henderson Barker Funeral Home is in charge. Turning now to the regular notices, beginning in Cedar Rapids, Dawn Lynn Dennis, age 67, passed away Sunday, December 31st at her home with her loving family by her side. Private family services will be held at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, with burial at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Dawn was born January 25, 1956, in Charleston, South Carolina, the daughter of Darrell and Mary Jane Antles Dayton. She graduated from Jefferson High School. Memorials may be directed to the Old Orp Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Please share a memory of Dawn at murdochfuneralhome.com. From Tiffin, Michael Jacob Sheets, age 75, died Monday, January 1st, following a sudden illness. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, January 8, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Oxford. Visitation will be Sunday, January 7, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the church. The rosary will be recited at 2:30 p.m. on Sunday. Burial with military honors will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to the Michael Sheets Memorial Fund at Solon State Bank. A complete obituary and online condolences are available at lansingfuneral.com. From Coralville, Margaret, known as Marge, and Goodfellow, age 86, of Coralville, passed away December 31st. A visitation will take place on Monday, January 8, at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, 605 Kirkwood Avenue, Iowa City, from 1 to 3 p.m., with a service of remembrance following at 3. A full obituary is available at lansingfuneral.com. In Marion, Sonia M. Astor, age 86, died Saturday, December 30th at Silver Oak Nursing Center. Memorial services are at 1 p.m. Saturday, January 13th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. The Reverend Heather Hayes will officiate. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, January 12th at Cedar Memorial. Sonia was born February 16, 1937 in Olwine, the daughter of Earl and Glenola Crawford. She graduated from Arlington High School in 1955 and earned a two-year teaching certificate at Upper Iowa University. Memorials are suggested to First Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids. In Cedar Rapids, Frederick Leon Smith, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on December 14 at his home. He was a butcher for Wilson's Farmstead and worked for the USPS loading dock. He was a scorekeeper for Jane Boyd and a DJ for KOJC Radio. A devoted father, he's survived by his daughters. In Cedar Rapids, Joan L. Lund Derleen, age 86, passed away at Unity Point St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday, January 3, surrounded by her family. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home Friday, January 5th from 4 to 7 p.m. A private graveside service will be held at a later date at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery Garden of Serenity. Joan was born February 22, 1937 in Stoughton, Wisconsin, the daughter of the late Gilbert and Olga Dahl Lund. And we would like to thank the entire staff at St. Luke's Hospice Team for their love and support. Online condolences may be shared at cedarmemorial.com. Also in Cedar Rapids, Jean M. Collis, age 100, passed away Sunday, December 24th at Living Center West in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of life services will be held at a later date. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids is in charge. Jean was born in Benton, Wisconsin in 1923, the daughter of Edward and Rika Ames Powers. And from Toddville, Brent Gordon Harstad left a footprint on our community. He was a father and a husband, a judge and a businessman, and most of all, he was a good friend. Brent was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, November 5, 1943, to Gordon and Bernice Christensen Harstad. Brent left us on Christmas Day with a warmth that shone from his life. He would want his legacy to be one of humor, friendship, and love. Please share a happy memory with others, and if it moves you, please share your generosity with memorials directed to Junior Achievement of Eastern Iowa, the Rotary International Foundation, or another charity of your choice. A community celebration of life will take place on Saturday, January 6th at 2 p.m. at Grand Living at Indian Creek, 325 Collins Road Southeast in Cedar Rapids. A visitation for the family to greet friends from 3 to 5 p.m. after the service. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services. Please share your love and support with Brent's family on his tribute wall. From Belle Plaine, Lynn Gosson, age 74 and formerly of Grinnell, died at his home on Saturday, December 30. A funeral service with military honors will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 6th at the Smith Funeral Home in Grinnell. Interment will follow at Westfield Cemetery near Grinnell. The family will receive friends at the visitation held prior to the service beginning at 9:30 a.m. Memorials may be designated to Stephen Johnson Syndrome Foundation and mailed in care of the Smith Funeral Home and Crematory, P.O. Box 368, Grinnell, 50112. From Homestead, Kenneth Martin Hagen, born May 1, 1934, on the family farm south of Homestead, the son of Martin and Hilda Schwarting Hagen, graduated from Marengo High School in 1952. Celebration of Life service will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 6th at St. John Lutheran Church near Homestead. Burial will be at St. John Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation will be Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. A memorial fund has been established for St. John Lutheran Cemetery or Emmanuel Lutheran Church. Messages and tributes are welcome at powellfuneralhome.com. From Cedar Rapids, Roger Allen Welty, age 85, went to his heavenly home on Monday, January 1. He was a beloved husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. Memorial services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, January 6th at Knoll Ridge Christian Church, 7111 C Avenue Northeast, with his granddaughter, Reverend Stacia Fine, presiding. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, January 4 at Murdoch Linwood and an hour prior to the service at the church. Roger was born August 12, 1938, to Arthur and Leora Price Welty in Barberton, Ohio. Memorials are suggested to Knoll Ridge Christian Church. For a detailed obituary and to share a memory, please visit murdockfuneralhome.com. In Cedar Rapids, Joan Marie Leitner, age 91, of Marionville, Missouri, passed away at 6:20 p.m. Sunday, December 31st, at the Ozarks Methodist Manor in Marionville. Joan was born March 14, 1932, in Iowa City, the daughter of Clinton and Bernice Williams Ritchie. She was a 1950 graduate of West Liberty High School in West Liberty, Iowa. A memorial service will be held March 15th, 2 p.m. at the Missouri Veterans Cemetery in Springfield, Missouri. Arrangements are under the direction of Williams Funeral Home in Marionville. Online condolences may be left at williamsfuneralhomemo.com. In Cedar Rapids, Anna Williams. After an extended illness, Anna Williams fell asleep in death on Saturday, December 30. Anna Vieira Williams was born September 12, 1980 in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Wesley Williams and Elizabeth Jones. Anna is a longtime resident of Cedar Rapids. She attended Jefferson High School. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, January 6th at the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witness, 7121 Mount Vernon Road Southeast in Cedar Rapids. From Atkins, Kara Deanna Kors, born July 21, 1978, to Gloria Kors and Donald Williard, and raised by Gloria and Dwayne Janey, Kara was always adventurous, creative, protecting, and loving. Visitation for Kara is Friday, January 5th from 4 to 7 p.m. Funeral Mass is Saturday, January 6th at 10 a.m. Thank you to St. John's the 23rd and Father Richmond for everything you've done and are doing for our family. On December 29th, the Lord, with no notice, had called her home. She is loved by many and will be missed. And lastly, in Cedar Rapids, Jolene R. Kirkpatrick, age 74, of Yates Center, Kansas, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away after a brief illness in Chanute Hospital, Chanute, Kansas, December 14. Services for Jolene will be at 11 a.m. on Saturday, January 6th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will start at 10 a.m. To view the full obituary and leave an online condolence, please visit cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Turning now to the sports page, boys wrestling, Pirates' success built on a foundation of fight. This story by K.J. Pilcher. In Alburnett, the foundation had been set in toughness. A trait Alburnett coach, Clayton Rush, exudes and expects from his wrestlers, the same characteristic many of the Pirates already brought to the practice room. Opponents have to deal with the product. "We talk a lot about fight," Rush said, "the fight you have in a match and practice. Nothing fancy. When guys wrestle someone from Alburnett, they don't ever want to do it again. That kind of thing." Just 3 years after placing 46th at the Class 1A state tournament, Alburnett is back among the top 1A programs. The Pirates are ranked second in the Iowa High School Athletic Association dual rankings and tied for second in the IAWrestle.com tournament poll with 7 ranked wrestlers. The climb has been steady, finishing 9th in 2022 and 4th last season. The current Pirates possess skill and the willingness to learn, merged with that tough attitude. "I would say it's a pretty good combo," Rush said. "I enjoy having this group because of these two things. They're all really coachable, too. You mix all of those together and it can be a pretty fun thing." The Pirates' wrestling room is a battlefield of competition. Up and down the lineup, wrestlers sharpened their talents against each other. The challengers faced in duels and tournaments sometimes pale in comparison to training. "It's kind of sucky in practice with all the toughness around the room and having to wrestle everyone," said Alburnett Jr. Reese Klosterman, who was ranked 6th at 157 pounds. "It helps your mind in competition, knowing someone is not as tough as what you have to deal with every day." Emmett Fleshman won 103 matches as a 3-year start for West Lyon. He moved to Alburnett, and the wrestling room's energy struck him immediately. "The biggest thing that stood out to me was the intensity all the kids brought," Fleshman said. "It's not seen elsewhere as it is here." Fleshman was a state qualifier at 195 last season. He is ranked 5th at 215 with a 23-3 record. Fleshman tallied 13 pins and 5 more forfeits and has been a big addition to the lineup. "I thought it went well," he said. "I had a few matches that didn't go my way, but overall, I felt I competed really well the first half of the season." Alburnett proved it could compete with any size school, posting a 16-3 dual mark in the first half. They picked up wins over 1A, 2A, and 3A teams, placing 6th at the 32-team Battle of Waterloo dual tournament. The Pirates won the Cliff Keen Independence Invitational and Western Dubuque's Bobcat duels. "This is the best team I've ever been on by far," Fleshman said. "The way we compete, we could probably be with anyone in the state." State finalist Rowdy Neighbor at 120 and state medalist Tayton Kufel at 132 are both ranked 3rd. Atlee DeWitt, a sophomore 106-pounder, is 4th. Preston Klosterman at 144 is 5th, while Dawson Becker is 10th at 150. The Pirates have a direct, workmanlike philosophy. The emphasis is not on punching in, but what is done while on the clock. "We work hard in the wrestling room," Rush said. "We're in there for an hour and 20 minutes to an hour and 30 minutes max. When we're in there, we're working our butts off." All the competition has created a good camaraderie. The bond extends beyond the wrestling mat. Many spend their free time with teammates. "I think the team gets along really well," Klosterman said. There are a lot of kids who hang out after school. Al Burnett returns to action with Tri-Rivers Conference Duels before wrestling at Highlands Gary Curtis Invitational on Saturday, along with Wilton, which is tied at number 2 in 1A. The Pirates are a heavy favorite in the Tri-Rivers Conference. The Pirates are also major contenders for a state duels and traditional state tournament trophy. They have balance, depth, and big point scorers that make their state title aspirations a possibility. In sports of area interest today, boys wrestling finds Prairie at Jefferson, Iowa City West at Washington, Linmar at City High, Western Dubuque at Kennedy, Dubuque Wallard is at Xavier, Regina and West Branch are at Wilton are at Anamosa, Liberty is at Cedar Falls, Marion and Solon are at South Tama. That's for the boys. In girls wrestling, Marion and Solon are at South Tama. Regina plays boys basketball at Lisbon, and the girls also play those games at 5:30 and 7:15. Turning now to the Things to Do column in the community category, Advocate Toolkit Launch. The library will be sharing a new resource for library advocacy, the Advocacy Toolkit. Attend a brief presentation and have the opportunity to ask questions. That's at the Cedar Rapids Public Library from 5:30 to 6:30, and that is free. And also at the Cedar Rapids Library, join the monthly tango practice. With participants will learn the basic steps of the tango and grow their skills in an encouraging and welcoming group. No partners required. Smooth-soled shoes are recommended, and registration is recommended but not required. That's from 6 to 7:30 p.m. tonight at the Cedar Rapids Library, and that is free. In the museum category, scavenger hunts are available for kids and adults at the Visitor Services Center at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. That is from 5 to 8 p.m. today, and that is free. And at the Cedar Rapids Public Library, the book group for women's studies is for those who enjoy reading fiction and nonfiction selections by, for, and about women, reading about different cultures and historical perspectives, and being introduced to new authors, new ideas, and new friends. January's book, Of Women and Salt, is by Gabriela Garcia. That's from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Cedar Rapids Library, and that is free. Finishing up with a brief look at the weather, partly cloudy skies today with a high of 32 in Cedar Rapids and a low of 22. Those partly cloudy skies stick around for the rest of the week. The normal high today is 28. The normal low is 12. The record high of 54 was set in 1997. The record low of 21 degrees below zero was set in 1999. Sunset tonight at 4:49, sunrise tomorrow at 7:35. That gives us 9 hours and 14 minutes of daylight. And we're in the last quarter of the moon phase with moonrise at 1:30 and set at 12:18. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, January 4, on IRIS. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Ready.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.